History Teachers Talking podcast short lectures have now grown up and moved to their own channel. Don't forget to subscribe to our new podcast, History Shorts, wherever you're listening to this episode. Meanwhile, thanks for listening to History Teachers Talking, and here is your newest episode. This is Peter.
And this is Tom.
And you're listening to History Teachers Talking podcast.
Part of the Evergreen Podcast Network.
All right, this is Peter Zablocki and Thomas Reska, and welcome back to our podcast. What do we got today, Tommy?
Today we're going to talk about something that every American definitely has heard of, is definitely aware of, and we probably mentioned it sporadically over the course of doing the show the last couple of years. So we're going to take an in-depth look now, kind of a deep dive into the Boston Massacre.
Yes. As just mentioned before we click record, also known in Great Britain as the Incident on King Street. So they don't teach it as the Boston Massacre. They teach it as Incident on King Street, which I had no idea until doing research for this. That's you think Britain. I would have known this after all this time.
That's Britain. This is America. We call it the Boston Massacre.
That is true. I learned a lot of things doing this. You know, it's interesting because I teach this, and it kind of gets jumbled in. You teach it too. Every teacher that teaches U.S. history teaches this. And it all gets jumbled in with your, you know, Stamp Act and the Townsend Acts.
That pre-revolution stuff.
Yeah, but like when you look at it by itself, a lot of interesting, I'll just say, and we'll get to them today, a lot of interesting things came up while I was doing this research that I was perhaps either unaware of or just simply not paying attention to while I was just, you know, lumping it in with everything else. So we are, of course, talking about the confrontation in Boston between the British redcoats and American colonists on March 5th, 1770. And the final result, as most of you might know, or maybe if you remember or don't remember from school, is the fact that 9 British soldiers shot into the crowd. And it wasn't just like, you know, 20, 30 people. There was like 400 people harassing them. And this was publicized as a massacre and really became the rallying cry eventually over the years.
That's what people, I don't interrupt you, that people, a lot of people don't understand it. It's not like this happened and then there was like independence. Yeah. It's happened in 1770.
Yeah.
So like there was still another 6 years, 5, 6 years before really that independence, Declaration of Independence and the war, like in Concord don't happen to what, 1775. This is that prequel stuff. This is the stuff that leads up to it. Even the massacre, I think we should do a little bit of like what predated it too, to kind of set the stage for what took place too. But yeah, like you're saying, there's a lot more to it than just the British soldiers shot some people.
Let's get us started with some background, right? We're talking about 18th century Boston, right? Boston is the capital of Massachusetts Bay Colony. It's one of the three major cities in the colonies at the time. Boston, Philadelphia, and New York being the main three. And definitely one of the most, if not the most, influential political, economic, and cultural center of the 13 colonies. Most of these things that we talk about when we talk about American Revolutionary War really originate and start right there in Boston. That's the center of resistance.
Oh, that's just, you had the Sons of Liberty, right? They were from Boston, that area. So they were the ones. It's also because Boston was a port city, right? For the most part, as Massachusetts was, like a lot of the ports and everything. Trade was really important. And a lot of those taxes that we'll get to, the Townsend Acts, which basically go in place at this time, were all there to really affect the people in Boston. It affected the wealth. It affected their livelihoods in a lot of ways. They were kind of left alone for a long time, right? The Boston colonies, all the colonies were. They were left alone quite a bit of time by the British. They would call it neglect, whatever you want to really like sum it up as. But that all changed after the French Indian War. So after the French Indian War, but basically the British Parliament enacts those Townsend Acts that we talked about earlier, because they basically needed to try to get more money. Now they saw the colonies as a way to kind of pay back that war that lasted from 1754 to 1763. And these acts were put in place for that. And now all of a sudden, out of nowhere, the people are getting mad because he has tax on lead, glass, paper, paint, obviously tea. The Sons of Liberty and some of these other radical groups try to organize like boycotts. A lot of other people are just like, fine, we'll pay the tax. It's not that much. We'll pay it because that's just what we're doing. We're still subjects of England. They're still very loyal to the king at this point.
The very reason why you even get to Townsend Acts, the very reason why Britain feels the need to impose these duties on different imported goods, right, is to collect revenue that was intended to pay for the salary of royal officials in the colonies. And the royal officials in the colonies, you had a royal governor of every colony, number one, right? So the prior to this, this is the big key here, during this salutary neglect that you mentioned, where England kind of stepped back and allowed everyone
to do their own thing. There was across
the land. To do their own thing. Absolutely.
Whatever.
One of the things that wound up happening is the local assemblies in the colonies actually were responsible for paying the salary of each royal governor, which is, if you think about it, kind of stupid, because the royal governor is supposed to represent England and the crown, right, in here in the colonies, and each colony has the royal governor, except that governor gets paid every single month. Their salary gets paid by the local assembly made up of local farmers or lawyers or whatever, which means, technically speaking, you have the locals that are running the show and not the governors. And what winds up happening after the Sugar Act, and which is repealed because, you know, there's all kinds of uprising. Yeah. Stamp Act 1765, a year after the Sugar Act, is repealed because of widespread protests and boycotts. Then the Quartering Act comes in 65. Quartering Act is required because you have to have British soldiers brought over to the colonies to kind of quell some of this rebellion and these protests and boycotts. So, like, you got to house them somewhere.
And all those people that you were talking about, those, like, local officials, asked for the British to send over regiments. And that's basically what happened, because a lot of the businesses that weren't going along with the boycotts were being vandalized, people were being harassed. So they asked the British officials for help, and the British sent over to Boston the 14th and 29th regiments of the British Army to Boston. They arrived in October of 1768. And this is kind of already... there's already heightened tension, and now you're setting these red coats in there. It's just making it more. Everyone's getting like on their feet, like they're getting really like anxious and stuff.
Yeah,
they're ready to go.
And the Townshend Acts, the very final act, which was kind of the lead up. That's the last lead up, right, to the Boston Massacre. That Townshend Act of 67 that imposed all those duties, it was designed to pay the salary of those royal, as I mentioned, those royal officials, those royal governors. So finally, England realized, like, we need to be able to pay the governors ourselves. It has to come from British money, so we have control over them again. So we're just going to tax all of these local colonists, you know, paper, glass, tea, whatever, and then we'll take that money and we'll pay the salary of these governors. But the Townshend Acts kind of blew up in their face. There's a lot of resentment towards it. And you also have this new job of these tax collectors because of these taxes through the Townshend Acts. And that leads us, like I mentioned, directly into what winds up happening in Boston.
Yeah, a little bit before this, like you have what's happened in the early 1770. You have basically the boycott, like you're talking about, and these colonial radicals, many of them were the Sons of Liberty. They began going against these local businesses, but a lot of them, like we talked about, they basically ignored it. And then there was one individual known as Ebenezer Richardson, who was known as kind of this radical. He was known as basically an informer. He tried to take down a lot of the signs that they put up above his shop and stuff like that. And then there was this young boy. His name was Theophilus Littill, basically. Yep. And when I say little boy, he was literally like, I think he was like young teenager.
And was he 13?
He was 13, yeah.
Yeah.
But it was a whole group. There were 13-year-olds, 12-year-olds, 11-year-olds. They were, you know, much more harder than like the boys today, obviously. Yeah. Like, these kids were like living on the streets of Boston in the 1770s. But they drove Richardson out of it back to his home. Like he ran away and stuff. That he was getting they were throwing stones at him, and actually broke his front door, some of his windows. And then another man, who's his neighbor George Wilmot, actually comes in his defense, and they armed themselves with muskets, right? And they fired a musket at this group, and they kill or they hit this young boy named Christopher Snyder. This you're going to see some different, sometimes it's Snyder with a Y, Snyder with an I, depending on the sources that you look at. And the boys die later that night. And the mob, there was actually a mob gathered. They wanted to basically go and just kill Richardson at that moment. But other people kind of convinced, like, no, let the courts do this. You know, we'll, you know, let justice be served that way. So tensions are running high at this funeral. Brawls basically broke out between the soldiers and a bunch of these rope makers. This is actually when you get the saying, the end of the rope. This is where this comes from. So this is in Boston's south end in March of March 2nd and 3rd of 1770. The British troops actually arrive the next day searching the ropeworks owned by a man named John Gray. And they were looking for a sergeant that they believed that he could have been murdered. And Gray had heard the British troops were coming to attack his workers. Or that's like the rumor. So he consulted with some other commanders of these 14 regiments. And they both agreed that they would basically restrain anyone who tried to do anything. And this leads to rumors. So both sides are kind of just like playing this game of telephone, right? Which is just causing more and more problems for both sides.
And this is literally just like a day before the massacre.
Day before, yeah. And the mob is just getting bigger. In the morning of March 5th, they started posting all these like, I guess you would call them propaganda, really like hate mail, right? About the British soldiers and putting them all over Boston. So the soldiers are reading this. They're told by their superiors, you know, be ready to defend themselves. And then there's a big crowd that night where you have all these Bostonians roaming the streets of anger. A lot of them were like drinking and stuff like that. And what really made them mad too is there was a rumor that the soldiers were going to cut down the Liberty Tree. This Liberty Tree was a place where during the Stamp Act, which has since been repealed, they hung up an effigy. You know, when they like make like a puppet or something of somebody, or like in this case, they would just dress up like a bunch of like sticks and leaves as like a red coat and burn it on this tree. So they hung a whole bunch of effigies on the tree during the Stamp Act. So it became kind of this like symbol of Boston. It was actually even a copper plated sign that read the Tree of Liberty. And the idea was that the rumor was that the Redcoats were going to cut it down. And this is what swelled a lot of this anger. But about 50 to 60 people all came and started to go after the barracks in Boston.
On the evening, March 5th, right? So you already have this tension. The town is pretty much, you have these bands of people running through the town, ready to ultimately almost like start an incident.
Oh, they were fired up, yeah.
Yep. So evening, March 5th, you have a private named, his first name was Hugh. His last name was White. Hugh White, he stands guard duty outside Boston's Custom House, right? It's on King Street. Today is known as State Street, by the way. And as he's standing there, this private White, you know, he's defending the Boston Custom House, just him, 13-year-old boy named Edward Garrick walks by and starts picking on another British soldier, a lieutenant.
These are like 13-year-olds that are like picking on the British. They're like going after the British, at these British redcoats, like the most powerful army in the world. And they're like mocking them, calling them names.
And that's exactly what it was. Yeah, this 13-year-old Edward Garrick starts mocking this other soldier that was walking by. He wasn't even a soldier on duty. It was John Goldfinch. It was just another, you know, lieutenant, captain, walking by. And this 13-year-old starts mocking him like, oh, did you pay your bill? Did you pay your bill? And Goldfinch, kind of this lieutenant, starts ignoring him a little bit. And Private White, who's standing guard outside Boston Custom House, he's kind of annoyed by this. So he's yells over to the 13-year-old Garrick. He's like, listen, you got to be more respectful. This is an officer. You can't talk to him like that. And then Garrick talks back to him. And at that point, White gets upset. So he like leaves his post, walks down and challenges this little kid. And they start arguing back and forth. And White strikes him on the side of the head with his musket. And at that point, Garrick falls to the ground and he cries out in pain and he like screams. And Garrick's friends, also 13, 12-year-old, whatever, nearby, they start screaming at White, like, why did you do that? Why did you hurt him? And a larger crowd starts getting, you know, it's kind of starts coming in here. Bigger, and especially, bigger. As you said, there's already crowds around the city. So before you know it, it's like 20, 50, and this swells up to ultimately about 400 people are there. One of the people that is a witness is Henry Knox, eventually, you know, Fort Knox. And at the time, he's only 19 years old. He's like a bookseller, eventually becomes a general. The little kid, Edward Garrick's still there, and he's still cursing Private White. At that point, because there was so many Bostonians that were angry coming at him, the lieutenant winds up running up to past the customs house and for assistance, right? And he gets Captain Thomas Preston. He's an officer of the watch at a nearby place, not even the same place, like nearby barracks.
They basically want to get the soldiers out of there. So Preston marches seven soldiers with fixed bayonets to go and try to rescue the sentry, which is basically that small group that's being there.
Yep.
And what they know is that the redcoats, the soldiers, were not read the Riot Act yet, which I know we call that now. We read the Riot Act. It's kind of another saying that comes from this. They were not allowed to fire their weapons. Until they read the Riot Act, they cannot fire their weapons. Right? So all they're doing is basically telling the crowd to disperse and stuff like that. And they're just constantly being taunted and stuff like that. A lot of people saying, you know, shoot us, shoot, see what's going to happen.
They kept on yelling, fire at us. Come on.
If you shoot, you're going to die. And they are pelting them with snow, ice, oyster shells. A lot of the snow, from if you read different accounts, was probably like snowballs, just, you know, rocks inside with ice. And they're just pelting constantly at the soldiers the whole time.
Hello, my name is Peter Zablocki, and I'm a historian, author, and college professor. I'm thrilled to invite you to check out Evergreen Network's History Shorts podcast. Every Tuesday and Thursday, join me on a journey through time, exploring the little-known and hidden gems of history. In each bite-sized episode, I'll dive into my original research to bring you intriguing historical curiosities you've probably never heard of, uncovering the fascinating stories that have shaped our world, from forgotten figures to overlooked events. And the best part? I've condensed all this historical goodness into manageable chunks, perfect for your on-the-go lifestyle. Whether you're commuting to work or squeezing in a quick break, History Shorts fits into the little time you probably think you don't have. Subscribe now and never miss an episode of the History Shorts podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts. And what's interesting, too, is because this obviously comes up right in court shortly thereafter, everyone believes that Preston was the one that ordered them to fire. But Preston was standing in front of these soldiers. Soldiers that got there was like six or seven of them, plus whoever was there, lined up in like a semicircular shape. And they have their muskets up, except Preston is not behind them, like saying, you know, get ready. No, Preston's standing in front of them. So clearly he did not say fire because he doesn't want to get shot. You know,
if anything, they were saying that's why he was standing there. He was saying, do not fire. That was basically what there's a lot of the historical records are saying, that he was saying, do not fire, do not fire, do not, you know, load your weapons. But also, like you said, these guys are being egged on, you know?
Yeah. And at the same time, well, now a lot of what we know about this comes from the court case that follows. But an object is thrown at Private Montgomery, right? And it knocks this private down, and he drops his musket. So apparently, I think that's what comes up later on, is that he gets up and he recovers his weapon, and he's like really angry, and he says, damn you, fire, supposedly. So at that point, when he says this, supposedly Private Montgomery, he was one of the two that was found guilty of manslaughter, he discharges his weapon into the crowd, although no command is given. The other soldiers,
hear one fire, they all start firing. Yeah.
Yep. First of all, someone just right away with his bat hits Montgomery over the arm, over his head and his arm. Then Preston gets hit, and Preston, the bullet just like flies by his head. He almost got his head shot off. So he drops to the ground, and then people start hitting him. And they said it was a slight pause. And once like the crowd realized that they're being shot at, they started to slowly like back away. So the shots hit 11 men, right? Three Americans died instantly.
So yeah, one of them was Crispus Attucks, right? Yep. Which was African-American sailor, probably a former slave, they're not really sure, who was shot and died almost immediately. And two of the other ones that were shot died later. And they wanted to stop for the violence. The crowd starts to disperse pretty much right after that, because again, they're being shot at. And Lieutenant Governor Thomas Hutchinson, who'd been summoned to the scene, and arrives right after the shooting takes place, he orders Preston and his contingent back to the barracks.
Yeah, because he runs inside, goes in a balcony, and yells at him from about. He's like, guys, he basically tells everyone, like, leave. I promise that there is going to be an inquiry. I promise those responsible will be held accountable.
Yeah, because he wanted to bring some sort of like peace to the city. And they did get peace, but it was an uneasy peace. So right afterwards, the very next morning, Preston and the seven soldiers that were there were all under arrest. And it was a town meeting that basically produced a demand for removal of all the troops. And by March 11th, both the 14 and 20 regiments had left Boston Harbor, because you're fearing for their safety and stuff like that. A lot of other custom officials, basically anyone who had like strong ties to the British, kind of left town for a little bit just to like see what was going on. And then there were a lot of delays, because this happened in March, and the arrangement didn't happen until September.
Well, they kept on delaying it. They kept on delaying it because you have this massive media battle that takes place where you have both sides are publishing these pamphlets. Yeah, they're publishing these pamphlets, you know, the Patriots, the Loyalists, like of what actually happened. And it's really inciting more violence. And
people riled up who weren't there. And that's when we talked about this in class. So when we did, you always show those images, right? Those pictures. I mean, they're drawings. Yeah. That makes it called a massacre. This is where the name becomes a massacre, because we're not trying to say, you know, any loss of life is not. I'm not.
Yeah, but this was not a massacre.
But it wasn't a massacre. Okay, yeah. You didn't have 40 people being killed, nowhere even close to that. You didn't have hundreds of people. Because you think massacre, you're like, oh my God. And when you see like the pictures or like those drawings, you always have the kids like analyze it. And I'll be honest, you know, in my district, they teach this. They teach it twice. They're teaching sixth grade, then again later on in the high school. But they're showing these images to sixth graders, and they're looking at it, and they can interpret, oh yeah, this is propaganda. They can just look at it, and how's it propaganda? Because you have the soldier looks like he's giving the fire. They're all aiming at them. Everyone looks like they're all running away. He doesn't show anything about them throwing snowballs and stuff like that. It shows the people like crawling away and still being shot. There's other ones where they actually show that the soldiers are stabbing them with bayonets, which did not happen. They even put dogs in it. I know the kids always did some picture with like a little
dog. Yeah, that was like, oh, I noticed a dog. Yeah,
there's a dog running away and stuff like that. So it's kind of like appeal to people's like, you know, sentimentality and everything. So, like,
but you know what the interesting about this is
propaganda. Like, it's obviously propaganda. On both sides. Because the British are doing it too. You just don't see that because we're on the other side.
Well, actually, a lot of these pamphlets were published in London because they're trying to influence the opinion in London of like, look at the colonists. They're so ungrateful and terrible, and they're attacking our soldiers, and our soldiers had no choice. But the one interesting thing here is because we all use Paul Revere's engraving. I feel like every teacher has used it. Yeah. And every person's knows of the Boston Massacre is like, oh yeah, Paul Revere, I got that. But actually, the main engraver was Henry Phelim, was an engraver that first depicted this engraving. The silversmith and engraver Paul Revere copies the image that is already engraved, and he kind of tweaks it a little bit, but it's almost identical. I mean, if you have to say like plagiarism of a painting or of an engraving, this would be it. So his is the one that becomes famous for some reason, the Paul Revere one. But in reality, when you look at it, it's actually, he was not the original guy that made it.
Henry Phelim was, yeah, but Paul Revere becomes famous for other things, reasons later on, and it kind of comes back. Oh, he did the engraving with the Boston Massacre. But all this like propaganda, a lot of it was done by Sam Adams, right? Samuel Adams was basically the one that called it a horrible massacre. He's the one that he's known as a skillful protagonist. So he knows how to get people robbed up, and that's what he's doing here.
So let's talk about the trial itself, because this is a very famous or infamous trial, depending which way you want to look at it. And the one thing is that you have John Adams, who already is, you know, he's a leading patriot in the city. He's known. He's an attorney. He's thinking of running for public office. He's not the John Adams you eventually get to know. He's not vice president of anything yet.
I saw interrupt you. And the HBO special that they did on Adams, they show him that actually, like, coming when the Boston Massacre takes place, like right back to Boston, he's there the night of, and he's like holding the dying boy in his arms in the movie. That never happened in real life. John Adams wasn't there when that took place.
It's one of those Hollywood, So everyone wants to have a fair trial. That's the key. The government wants a fair trial.
We know that's important to do.
But nobody wants to defend them. So Preston sends a request to John Adams pleading for him to work on the case. He's like, look, I've heard this John Adams guy is really good. No one else wants to take up my case. So we don't even know how many people he sent a request to prior to John Adams. But John Adams is the one that finally says, all right, like, I'll do this.
Yeah, no, he doesn't really ever give a reason to. Like, that's another thing that I thought was interesting is that, like, they don't really know why he decided to. Was it just because he was, everyone deserved a fair trial? He was a supporter of that, right? He did have... Was it because he wanted everyone to know he had a high respect for law? He also, Sam Adams was his cousin. He didn't like the violent antics of his cousin, the Sons of Liberty, so I think it was more of a protest to that. But he had his reasons, had his personal reasons that are really not well known. But he does do it. Think about it. You are going to be the lawyer for the soldiers of the Boston Massacre. It's not going to be an easy
Well, they would throw bricks through his window. They would literally throw bricks through his window. At his wife, you know, would be harassed in the streets. People were like, why are you doing this? And his one thing that was kind of smart on his part is he separated the actual trial. So Preston was trialed separately, and then the soldiers that opened fire were trialed separately. And he did this because for Preston's defense, he looked at it, did he order the troops to fire? Like, that was his whole defense. And because no one could prove that he ordered them to fire, Preston is let go. He's acquitted. So, and then the trial for the soldiers begins. And even that one, John Adams is like, look, forget that these guys are British. Let's just think of a bunch of people. There's a crowd. There's provocation and soldiers, whether they're
fleeing from the life and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. He described the slave, Crispus Attucks, and he actually says, again, part of the times, I guess, his very look was enough to terrify any person. And with one hand, he held a bayonet and with the other knocked the man down. And then he starts talking the same thing about other members that were there in a crowd. And he's describing of like kind of how scary this was. And my assumption is when he's talking about the former slave, his very look enough to terrify a person is probably a racist connotation to that, of racism at times. There's some contradicting statements because some people are saying like, well, Attucks wasn't really that close. He wasn't the first one up there hitting anybody. But Adams really stuck to this Attucks behavior. It's like an old probability.
He was dead, so he's not like he was there to defend himself either.
Exactly.
He could spend whatever narrative he wanted to.
Yeah.
You know?
And that became his thing, though. He's like, it was this angry black man coming at them. And then he basically argues that the soldiers have the right, legal right, to fight back against any mob. And therefore, because they have the right to fight back and protect their own lives, they are innocent, regardless whether they're provoked or not. So they were mostly found not guilty.
Well, Preston was found innocent. All the other soldiers were, well, except for two of the enlisted men, were found innocent. The two, he actually argued their convictions down to manslaughter. And they did. Then remember, this is not the American legal system. This is the British legal system at the time. Yeah. So they invoked something known as the plea to clergy, which is like an ancient tenet of English law. And they negotiated their sentences down to just branding of their thumbs for first-time offenders. So they all go free. But what this does do is it paves the road to the revolution, like we talked about, because people are not going to forget this. This is still part of the narrative. And it really gets John Adams on the center stage. He's going to wind up becoming one of the founding fathers and then eventually a future president.
Did you see that four civilians were tried on December? They waited a month, another month after this even, because these take place in November. That's how long they wait from the event. But a month later, this four civilians are put on trial as well for inciting this rebellion, causing violence. And they are all acquitted. One guy is like the one that was like really bad, supposedly, is like whipped and banished from the province. But it's not like the civilians were not put on trial either. There was, there's four that were considered like these are the rebel rousers, the ones that started it.
The British weren't going to tolerate that sort of stuff either.
Yep.
And this is also, we talk about, it paves the way to the revolution, but it's also another example why the British feel they have to be a little bit tighter now. They have to watch these Sons of Liberty, these other people in Boston,
Yeah, and interestingly enough, Samuel Adams, like you said, a cousin, creates like an annual holiday called Massacre Day.
Oh, he's not letting anyone forget it,
Yep, for every year after that, until the American Revolutionary War starts 7 years later. The one boy that was wounded in the attack apparently lived until 1780, and then he winds up dying. It is a contribution to American Revolution, but this is not the last big development between the two. And they said it's considered significant. But as we mentioned from the very beginning, this happened in 1770. It's not like the next month they're like, all right, we're going to war with Britain.
I wouldn't say it was a cause of the revolution either.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Like people, I always got like when kids think, oh, what was the cause of the revolution? Boston Massacre, Boston Tea Party. It's like, but what happened? What caused those events to take place? Those are the real cause of the revolution. These were just kind of incidents that happened on the road to revolution. I wouldn't argue that they were a cause.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely strains the relationship between Britain and its colonies, but that relationship was already strained. So it's just adding fuel to the fire. And eventually there's just, enough is enough.
But they do still reenact it today on March 5th. The Bostonian Society does this.
Really?
They do it. It's part of Boston's Freedom Trail. Also, if you ever go to Boston, you take the Freedom Trail.
That one's actually really cool. And there was a sign, interesting enough, right in front of the Customs House. There's like this circular sign in a ground that says, this is the site of the Boston Massacre. That's actually incorrect. The real place of the massacre is like 50 feet to the right of that sign, but that would put you in the middle of a very busy road today. They moved it.
They have to be practical with their historical accuracies.
Yeah, they're like, we want a road here, so it's kind of over here. So obviously somebody's playing. I mean, John Adams becomes somebody. It becomes a big deal. Eventually,
just a little bit.
Eventually you have the Tea Act comes out of 73, which brings you to Boston Tea Party, which leads you to Intolerable Acts, which ultimately shut down the Boston port, which is, like as I mentioned before, one of the main three colonial cities.
Colonial ports, right? Yeah. That's where things came in from Britain or around the world. You need that port open if the colonies were going to make money, especially if Massachusetts was going to make money.
Yeah, and then collectively, you start adding all these things up, these last intolerable acts, that this fuels a sense of injustice and its oppression, right, among the American colonists. And that is what ultimately contributes significantly to the growing discontent and eventually erupts into the American Revolutionary War. Yeah, I think that's pretty much it.
We summed it up. Yeah, they summed it up.
Da-da-da-da. Anyway, as always, if you guys want to find out more about this, just, you know, go Google, or you could always shoot us an email. Maybe we can help you out with some of this stuff. But if you need to find us, you guys can find us at www.historyteacherstalkingpodcast.com. We are there to answer any of your questions. Thank you so much for your support, guys. Make sure you click that like and subscribe button wherever you listen to this podcast. And we will see you guys again next week.
Stay safe, everybody.
I hope everyone enjoyed our podcast, and if you would like to email us, you can do so at historyteacherspodcast@gmail.com.
Hello, everyone. My name is Tom Kearns, and I host the Anglo-Saxon England podcast, where I cover the history and culture of England from the departure of the Romans in the 5th century to the Norman conquest in 1066. So far, we've surveyed the collapse of Roman rule in Britain, the migration of the Anglo-Saxons, and the history of Northumbria from its beginnings in the mists of legend to its destruction at the hands of Viking raiders in the 9th century. I hope you'll come and give it a go.